So, good morning, or those of you who are in morning, as I am in US Pacific time, and good afternoon and good evening to those of you who are in afternoon and evening spaces. So, here we are. It's really lovely to be here with you. And I thought we could begin with the dedication, just put ourselves in the right frame of mind, the right space for doing this Q&A. And then I'll start by reading a passage from the Yoga Vasishtha, not just to put us in the mood, but to remind us of what it is that we're actually here for. So you can find your posture. By the power of our practice, may all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all beings be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. May all beings know the sacred joy that lies beyond suffering. May all beings be free of craving, hatred, and dullness. May we know the unity of all that lives. And we offer this practice for the benefit of all beings and for the earth itself. And I'm just going to chant the first verse of the introductory mantras, which says, salutations to that beingness in which all the elements and all the animate and inanimate beings shine as if they have an independent existence, and in which they exist for a time, and into which they merge. Yata sharvani bhutani prati banti stitani cha yatraivo pasamam yanti tasmai satyat mane namaha tasmai satyat mane namaha tasmai satyat mane namaha. Satya mane means the true self, true being. And that's who we are, and that's who we're talking to today in the shape and form of all of us. So, and as I was reading the Yoga Vasishtha today, I kept coming across these statements that I wanted to read to you. They're not way too many of them to read, but here we go. O Rama, the conditioned mind alone is bondage. Liberation is when the mind is unconditioned. The conditioning of the mind drops away when the truth is clearly seen and realized. And when the conditioning has ceased, one's consciousness is made supremely peaceful. To realize that the self alone is all this, whatever one may think of anywhere, is clear perception. Conditioning and mind are but words without corresponding truth. When the truth is investigated, they cease to be meaningful. This is clear perception. When this clear perception arises, this is liberation. So, listening to this, we say, okay, all I need to do is get rid of my conditioning. But then Vasishtha points out, you can't get rid of your conditioning one piece at a time because it's your conditioned mind that's trying to get rid of the conditioning. So, but conditioning dissolves when we see the untrammeled truth, the light, the consciousness, beingness, and bliss of the great truth. And at least in my experience, and I think this is pretty true of many of you, that because we have periodic glimpses of that truth, we feel it, we enter into it. And every time we do, another piece of our conditioning is dissolved. So, in other words, in this process, as we, as it were, submit ourselves to being in a quiet place in the mind, then little by little, that awareness, that being, that Brahman, if you want to, you know, really get into the way the text talks about it, that literally dissolves whatever creations have arisen in the mind that keep us from steadily knowing what's within all this and behind it. So that being the basis of everything that we're talking about, I'd love to take your questions. So you can raise your hand, Deb will call on you, or you can put the question in the chat. Okay, who'd like to ask the second question? And by the way, you don't have, the questions do not have to be on this exalted plane. It's completely fine to ask a practical question or a question about something that's been confusing. So Maria has a question.
Sorry, can you hear me?
Yes.
I couldn't unmute. I mean, I couldn't find the raise my hand button, so I just put it there. But hi, Sally.
Hi, how are you?
I'm okay. So just sort of, you know, what you were just saying about that quote, because it is sort of, that is sort of what my question was about, was like when you begin to have those moments more and more of just being in that awareness and feeling that awareness and feeling like that's more and more the truth, you know, like what I don't even know how to explain it, where that sense of freedom and that sense of that dream state that you were mentioning, how our mind becomes more like a dream, or our life becomes more like a dream, the more we connect to that spaciousness and awareness. And so with understanding that, you know, how does that, you said more and more, you know, it just sort of, sorry, I'm not being very clear, the conditioning dissolves. And so I guess, and how that kind of connects to the quantum world, like how it almost seems like when you gave that example of that man who couldn't walk, or he had a spine injury, and then he just kind of got to the point where he could walk again. And so I'm just wondering, how does the mind, or is it really through that connection to awareness and consciousness that more and more that we just can almost create our futures? I mean, that's really, I guess, the question.
That is pretty much what the text is saying. That once you have the capacity to, let's say, allow that background awareness to come to the foreground, then and once it starts to infuse your mind, a cat has come into the chat, has come into the gallery. Once you allow that awareness to infuse your mind, then it begins to act through your mind. And, you know, I think we can all think of examples of people who can do this. You know, it's part of what psychic channeling is about. It's part of what, you know, exercising certain siddhis, certain understandings is about. You can intuitively have a connection to that underlying consciousness, which is a repository of all the wisdom in the world. And it gives you pieces of wisdom, not everybody all the same wisdom. But my experience as a writer and as a teacher has been that at a certain point in my life, I began to actually petition consciousness, petition the power of being behind my mind to come forth and you know, write something that I couldn't figure out with my mind, or just express itself through my words.
Right.
And, you know, I think many of you here have done that one way or another, right? So In other words, we already know what it's like to have a connection with consciousness. Now, this guy who cured himself of paralysis obviously had a very strong mind, very powerful will. But, you know, and Vasishtha would say his ability to do that was the result of his effort, his will. What I would say, and Vasishtha says this in different places, is that because his will was connected to the underlying awareness, consciousness, the being, consciousness, bliss, then it was empowered. And this is available to all of us. Mm-hmm. Difference is that most of us don't have that power of focus, concentration, and, you know, haven't honed our will to the point where we can stay in touch with that and be clear about our intentions. And I would say this is a good thing, since many people have unpurified intentions. You know, if everybody could do that, we'd be in trouble. So, you know, and that's why sadhana is so important. That's why this teaching, it has historically been given to, let's call it an elite, but by elite, we mean an elite of people who really worked on themselves, who really have powerful motivations. But yes, you can do that.
Okay.
It's doable. Yes. So Maria, does that answer your question, or are you?
Yeah. I just, you know, I guess it's just really, the more you meditate and the more you sit, the more, I just feel like it happens more. I think it continues to happen.
Yeah, it does. It's an ongoing process. It's not a one shot.
Right.
Oh my God, I'm a bound soul. And now I got it. I'm free.
Right.
This it's little by little.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. So, and what that means, practically speaking, is that we keep on keeping on. And I consider myself sort of a poster child for the gradual path. You know, it's at first it seems impossible that you would ever get to a state where your mind could become clear. And little by little, it becomes easier and easier. And eventually a time comes when, you know, your mind can be unconditioned for periods of time.
Right.
That's how it works. So the beauty of this text is that it constantly reminds us of what the truth is and where we're going.
Right.
So we don't get caught in the side trails, including the siddhis, which are going to come to every one of you. If they haven't already, certain skills and talents and superpowers start to arise. And they're great. You know, they facilitate life, but the path is to the dissolution of all conditioning. Okay, so I know this is a deep set of questions. So I'm just going to go on. We're on the chat now. Hope asks, can you explain the importance of posture? So yeah, part of the importance of posture is simply getting yourself to sit still, because the secret, as you know, of turning inward is actually to still as many of the distracting elements as possible. And one of them is the body. So if you make the body upright and still, and as I say that, I know myself and some of you are never quite still, because the inner Shakti is making your body sway and move in increasingly subtle ways. And we don't want to rigidify our posture. But the main thing in posture is that your spine be upright, because the energy that transforms your consciousness is moving vertically from the base to the crown and back again. And we want to give it a smooth path to move, even though the path it moves on is in the subtle body. It's not in the physical body. Nonetheless, the container of it all is the physical body. And it's much easier for the energy to go back and forth along this pathway, opening different chakras, ultimately connecting us to the absolute. It's much easier to do that if the body's straight. So posture is important. And someone asks the question, which is, I think, a really good question. How do you tell the difference between dispassion and depression? The answer I was going to give, which is kind of tautological, is by how it feels. Normally, depression is accompanied by very powerful feelings of unworthiness, of being a victim, of things about your life that are not fixable. Dispassion is actually a recognition of the deep truth that nothing in the external world, including your relationships with the people you love, are going to give you ultimate satisfaction. That you know, there's actually a built-in sorrow-creating mechanism in the physical universe. And when we really start to see that, and we really start to realize how we chase so many things that are not going to give us ultimate satisfaction, that creates the feeling of dispassion. But it doesn't really, it can go along with a tremendous feeling that life is not worth living. But because we have the possibility of sadhana, because there's a way through this, a person who meets dispassion is going to allow the recognition of what's intrinsically problematic about human life, is going to allow that recognition to help her, to help him make use of this human body and mind, which are also, of course, the greatest gifts we can ever receive, in order to realize that which is beyond the suffering. In depression, we just fold our tent and wait for it to be over, or hopefully find some medication. So if you're looking at your own experience, this is one of the areas of where self-inquiry is really important, to begin to ask yourself, if you have experiences of depression, what does depression feel like? Where does it sit in my body? What's the state of my mind when I'm depressed? And then to look at your experiences of genuine dispassion, which I know we've all had, of seeing through the illusion, if you will, seeing through the whole panoply of hope, fear, expectation, desire, of just seeing that where it all leads to is just more coming and going. It's a different feeling. So, and it's really worth exploring. So thank you. Would someone like to ask a question?
Can we go with Rama Deve, if you want to unmute yourself?
Sure.
Hi, Renu.
How do we find the balance between contentment, quieting the mind, and giving attention to practical situations, for example, a broken window, without creating excessive or needless modifications of the mind? How do we know when we're overthinking?
Really good question. For instance, if you have a broken window, the natural solution is to find someone to fix it, right? To call around, find somebody who can put the glass back in the window. It's not a question that needs to be thought about a lot, except in the sense of, you know, picking somebody who can do the job for you. And that's what we call practical thinking. That's actually the use of thinking. It's to, you know, to help you make distinctions in life issues, life problems, that in which decisions have to be made. And in, you know, if you remember the way that the instruments of the mind are distinguished from each other in Indian spirituality. There's supposedly four aspects of the mind, one being the manas, which is the part of the mind that gets information through the senses and which we respond to in practical terms. There's the ahamkara, the ego, which divides everything into mine and inside and outside, mine and not mine. And then there's the buddhi, which is sometimes translated as intellect, which is the part of the mind that can make clear objective decisions. And finally, there's the citta, which is the whole mind field itself, including what in the West we call the unconscious, which, and you know, the citta is the field within which everything is arising. So in practical life, if your window needs fixing, what you would do is get in touch with that objective intellect part of you, the buddhi, and allow the buddhi to guide the process. And then you don't have to think obsessively. It's the manas that thinks obsessively, that comes up with thought after thought after thought. And the truth is, obsessive thinking is a habit that a lot of us have cultivated over a lifetime. And like all habits, we can break it. One of the ways we break it is really by asking the very practical question, what needs to be done now? You know, or some allied question. And putting the obsessive thinking aside, just I'll take you up later. I mean, there are many ways of dealing with the mind that can help you cure in a practical way a tendency to obsessive thinking. So thank you for that. I think
Ruthie had a question, Sally.
Ruthie, hi.
Hi, Sally. I have a question that sort of follows on the last one, which is that there's, there after the storms down here in Santa Barbara, they've decided to take all of the rocks and trees and dirt and dump it all into the ocean. And the particular place they're doing it is between an estuary and a seal rookery. And my question is, if using this quote, when the world appearance is seen as an appearance, it does not produce either elation or sorrow. So,
What do you feel about your absolute rage that they're doing this, as it were?
What did you say?
What do you do about your fury that they're doing this stupid thing?
Well, what I'm trying to do is to, get away from my activist mind of like, okay, I have to go to the city council. Okay, I have to write a letter, And from that place, ask what needs to be done. Yeah. I mean, in the way that you just answered the last question.
What needs to be done from a practical point of view? In other words,
yes.
Would it be a good thing for you, given your skills, to go to the city council or write a letter? I mean, that's a simple decision that you can make.
True, but how do you the appearance of what's happening here is don't I want to be in an equanimity state or no elation, no sorrow?
Ultimately. Yeah, you do. But if you've read the stories of great beings, and I'm thinking of Ramakrishna here, that it's not that enlightened people don't have emotions. It's not that they don't have reactions. You know, that's part of our humanness, is you see something unjust and it makes you angry or it makes you sad. The issue is, do you hang on to it? Do you let it make a home in your psyche? Or do you let yourself feel it in the moment? Do what you can do about it. If there's nothing you can do about it, actually honor it and let it go. I would say love it and let it go. Welcome this feeling of anger and injustice or stupidity or whatever it is as one of the qualities in the human mind that can change, that can turn, nasty realities into more benign realities.
Well, so, right. Yeah. But I guess my quandary or query rather is, I understand the mechanism of just loving it, or as you said, surrender, as David Hawkins would say, but But on the ground, you know, not when I'm in meditation, it's like, I mean, this feels so much like where the rubber hits the road of the humanness and how to bring the divine into the humanness, I guess.
Yeah, it is absolutely where the rubber hits the road, you know, God, what is her name? She's one of my favorite people. She's an ecological thinker who's also a Buddhist. Joanna Macy, thank you. This is why we need collective intelligence. So Joanna Macy, in one of her books, talks about, she's a nuclear waste activist, among other things. And she talks about running into a Buddhist friend on the street in Berkeley and telling her what she was doing. And her friend said, "Why are you bothering with all this? It's all Maya." And Joanna Macy, you know, the whole book is about how you can be an activist while also understanding that it's Maya. And that's the koan, you know, that's what we need to find for ourselves. If being an activist is what you do, you know, or even something you believe would be good if you did more of, then how are you going to do it? And also keep this awareness that you are not the doer, that the doer is. Yeah. So, I mean, that's the game. That's the koan. Congratulations. Yeah. There's no way out of it.
Yeah.
There's no way out of it.
Okay.
Yeah. But thank you for the question. I would say it is it's the question. How do we live a meaningful human life and make a difference in the world while realizing that it's all just an appearance in consciousness? You know, I mean, we have the possibility when we really get this teaching of living as enlightened beings live, which is acting, doing, loving, but without grasping, without hating, without, you know, zoning out. So, you know, your activism based on non-duality is one of the major things you're contributing to the world right now. So it's great.
Okay.
Does anyone else? Yes.
Ranu, if Ranu. You want to. There we go.
My question is really about dispassion. I think I've been in a state of dispassion for quite some time now, and it's been maybe at least a year, if not more. And I wonder if it also is accompanied by a feeling or a lack of bhakti. And I'm feeling even more worried about that aspect of it. If it is indeed dispassion, I know it's not depression because I've not given up on life in any way. But there is this sense of what's wrong with me, because I feel like I'm doing everything I possibly can. I sit almost every day. I sit first thing in the morning, and I sit for as long as I can with my full-time job, and then I try to sit for, you know, more sessions or read something that's contemplative, or, you know, I feel like I'm doing all the right things, but at the same time I'm not having the same kind of effect. When I used to first listen to you give us the instruction to think about awareness as awareness, it would be like there's a little bit of an electrifying feeling, and I'd feel light. I just felt like I got hit every time you used to say that, but it's absolutely not there anymore. And I, none of those things are switching it on for me anymore. And I'm like, what is going on here? So there's this a little bit of a fear, because I feel like I've been doing things that I should be doing. At the same time, though, I want to acknowledge, I feel like there are moments I feel like my life is guided, not in the way that it's magically, at least not yet, but I feel like I'm looking for a question, or I'm asking questions, and I see it here and there. But that's like the only kind of silver lining I'm able to find right now. So I was hoping maybe you could speak to this feeling of, extended dispassion.
Yes, I get it. Well, I think one of the things about becoming very familiar with non-dual teachings is that there's a quality, you often will get to the point where it doesn't grab you. And one reason for that is that it's one of the reasons why Vashishtha tells so many stories, because the human mind actually needs something to grab onto, and it needs novelty. We are very addicted to novelty. So what is going to happen eventually and it happens to me periodically, you know, I'm like, oh, okay, the non-dual teaching. Okay, right, I know this. You know, it's not that interesting to me right now. I'd rather meditate on a deity. You know, I'd rather learn some Sanskrit. I'd rather do a chant. Because the kind of, I'm trying, there's a way in which the non-dual teachings kind of iron out your consciousness. And at a certain point, the mind can't hook onto it. So here's what I suggest. One is that you dabble in different texts and different people's ways of describing this. Because, you know, one of the secrets of talking about non-duality is that we actually need to word it in different ways, not only to get other people to understand it, but also to get ourselves interested in it. So and it's true of, I would say, of any form of practice, if you're doing the same thing over and over and over again without sort of changing it up, without finding some way to be creative with it, essentially, you're going to start feeling that dispassion, which feels like disinterest. So just consider, what practice could you be doing that you're not doing now? Or what understanding could you be working with that you're not working with now, that might kind of jumpstart that feeling of excitement, or that might be hard for you, you know, challenging for you, so that it gets you to pay total attention to it? Because really what makes this kind of disinterest arise is that we've allowed ourselves to not fully focus on it because we feel we understand it. So you need something that's going to get you to focus. It's going to surprise you. It's going to be hard for you. It's going to demand that you give your whole mind to it. And that then what you discover is that this teaching is actually the most interesting and nuanced thing in the world, but you have to be engaging with it. And in the end, it's we who have to find our own way of engaging with it. I hope that helps, Renu. I also want to say that what you're going through is actually a normal stage in the process. It will change, but your willingness to dynamically interact with your practice is going to speed up that change. So do you feel like your question's answered, or is there more?
I think so. I think I was starting to have the suspicion that maybe I'm doing the same thing every day and I can't change it up much, because I have a teacher who has given me a sequence and it lasts me almost an hour and a half. And that's about as much I can manage before I start my day. So I know that that's stopping me. But I'm also finding, like I said, I'm finding myself guided towards things that I should look up, which excite me. And I'm like, ooh, so that day I have a good meditation, and then the next day I need something else. So yeah, I'm glad that you said all these things, because I'm like, okay, that's good to know.
Yeah, and I would say, if you have a sequence, in my practice, there's a lot of practices, chants, mantras that I have committed myself to doing every day. They take a long time, they take a couple of hours. And what I've found is that periodically, a couple of times a week, I just have to ditch the protocol and sit for meditation or get really involved in a particular chant. In other words, it's even if your teacher has given you a practice, even if you have vowed to do this practice regularly for, you know, however long you're doing it, nonetheless, it is actually okay. I'm giving you permission to, you know, to just let it go once or twice a week and get deeply into one aspect of it. And that's going to make a difference. Okay. I've silenced you. there's a balance that we're all creating, you know, especially those of us who are doing a serious graduated practice. We have to find the balance between, you know, committing ourselves to a particular practice and doing it over and over and over again, and to the creativity which allows us to surprise ourselves. Both of these two elements need to be in our practice. And everyone has their own way of getting that together. So you don't want to just be a dilettante and, oh, let me do this chant today and I'll do that chant tomorrow and never getting deep into anything. But you also don't want to let yourself get rigid or dry. And again, that's the Tai Chi of meditation practice.
Stella, do you want to go back to the chat? I think Karen Ellis had a question, and I'm guessing it was regarding dispassion and depression. So,
no, actually, Karen's question is, I sent this note on the listserv, and then I sent a version of it out to everyone with the homework, saying that some of the ways in which Tantra grows out of Vedanta and in which Vedanta evolves into Tantra. So Karen says, I can't stop obsessing, probably all the years of focusing on the Tantric experience. My mind is trying to turn itself inside out with some unanswerable koan regarding the reality of the intensely powerful waking and subtle dream states. For instance, when I've met my guru in what appeared to be the void, was it real or a dream? Trying to reconcile this with the mind is a futile endeavor. And then you answer your question. Maybe that's the point. You know, so yeah, this universe, which is an appearance in consciousness, is infinitely variable. And some aspects of it are light, let's say, are, you know, radically enlightening or, you know, love kindling, and some of them kindle feelings like disgust. And from a pure non-dual point of view, all of these things are simply part of the display. In terms of a person who's on the path, who's experiencing grace, who's creating habits of, you know, of inner knowledge, of you know, of higher will, etc., etc., there's a tremendous shift in what your dream state is like, in the way your mind works. In other words, this is one universe. So the experiences that are going to open your awareness, take you further along the path, blow your mind, they can happen in dreams, they can happen in the waking state. And since the dream state and the waking state is a state in which pure creative consciousness is utterly present, it's not a contradiction. So I hope that helps. It's, you know, you're right, the mind can't conceive it. But if you keep realizing that, you know, that what would you call it, that state of that absolute state, that utterly creative being consciousness bliss is everywhere. So why can't that create a guru and give grace to you in a dream state or in a state where you're experiencing nothingness or void, it's completely in tune with the utter radical creativity of consciousness. So appearing as a dream, appearing as your life, it's all within the bounds of possibility, and the mind can't touch that particular level of awareness. It's beyond mind, but it acts through the mind. So yes, trying to reconcile this with the mind is a futile endeavor. But by thinking about it and thinking about it and thinking about it, what happens is that you kind of send this koan into your awareness, and awareness will give you a resolution for it. You'll get it. And then the issue is to stay out of the thinking mind for a while and let that realization pickle. So thank you for that question. It's part of what we do. And we need to know when to engage the mind, when to disengage the mind.
So Sally, yes. I was going to have Andrew. He's been trying to ask a question.
And so. I believe I can speak. Do you hear me? I'm an inexperienced Zoom participant. Don't worry. Do a whole lot of this in my ordinary life. And this is a natural point. It seems a natural segue to what you were just saying. And I wonder if there is a conscious strategy by which you can hope to influence your unconscious life, your dream life, the life that you are having as you go to sleep. I believe you were saying that you can sort of intone, you can resolve that. You need the answer to something in your life, and could that come before you go to sleep, you resolve that you're going to have something in the realm of conscious sleep, conscious dreaming, but still, of course, retain the restfulness that comes from sleep. I can see how that could be contradicted if you're actually asleep. You can't be asleep and be awake, so to speak.
Yeah, you can.
Okay.
It's a pretty advanced state.
Yes.
I think I get what you're asking. And, you know, and so the answer is yes. There are techniques, practices for putting a question into your psyche before you go to sleep. The one I use, which I learned from a shaman, maybe in one of his Alberto Villela, I think his name is, where you just take a piece of paper and you write on the piece before you go to sleep. You sit on the side of the bed, you write "Dear Inner Self," or if you have a deity, you ask the deity, "If it is your will, please give me information in my dream that will answer the question, whatever it is." And, you know, so write it down, read it over, put it under your pillow, believe it or not. And a lot of the time, I would say, in my experience, 60% of the time, you'll come out with an answer. And you do it until you feel resolved. So that's a method that anybody can use. There are also teachers who teach lucid dreaming, especially in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. Namke Norbu has a book on lucid dreaming. Andrew Holacek writes and teaches about lucid dreaming. And there are a series of exercises that you can do which will kindle that capacity in you. You know, for instance, if you're, you know, in the Carlos Castaneda books, which are a lot of which are about...
I read those.
Yeah, so do you remember?
Yes, I remember that. You look at your hand before you go to sleep, and then you're going to find your hand in your dream.
Exactly. And you can train yourself. That's how you can train yourself to wake up in a dream.
And it doesn't, to your knowledge, it doesn't dissipate the level of restfulness, the depth of sleep that you're going to have by becoming more aware.
Let me amend that. There, when you're first beginning to work on with dreams and waking, you know, waking up in dream, there is, to a certain extent, your night is dominated by that activity. So I don't know if you've ever done dream work. Many of us have gone through a period where we've done kind of Jungian dream work, and we're told when you have a dream, you know, wake up, use your flashlight, write down the dream because you'll forget it. And you, if you're really into it in the initial stages of that, you just do it every time you have a dream. And most of those dreams are trivial, not worth recording. And eventually the practice kind of settles in and you remember the dreams that you're supposed to remember. So, you know, during the practice period of anything, it's going to be slightly awkward and it'll, you know, it'll fill up your mind and you'll have lots of questions about it. But eventually it becomes a habit of consciousness. And consciousness can hold a need for information or need for transformation through the dream state, through the deep sleep state, which is really where the answers come from. You know, all the answers in your to all the questions of life are hidden in what's sometimes called the Chittakasha or the Akashic record, which is inside your causal body, the body in which you enter in deep sleep. So it's all there. You don't have to, you know, you don't have to, and you can't, you know, unless you have that kind of skill set, which some people do. You can't necessarily, you know, go into your causal body and drag out the information you need. But if you put the prompt in, the causal body will give it back to you. And as I said, eventually it'll just happen in the course of the dream. You'll wake up and you'll know something.
I see. And is this at any point a natural unfolding of the progress on the path that somehow your unconscious life is permeated in a strong way so that you don't have a night of chaotic dreams that just wash over you, but you have more meaningful experience at the unconscious level?
Yes, it does. Okay. And you know, there are phases in sadhana, especially within awake kundalini, where your unconscious is going to send up endless dreams. Some of them, you know, if you've ever done a deep psychedelic journey, you know that there's parts of it that are disconcerting sometimes, and there are parts of it that are utterly exalted. And we seem to have to, this is my experience in ordinary life, you know, over the years of my sadhana, that early in the process, I would have lots of scary dreams, you know, sort of nightmare experiences, just dreams that made me uncomfortable. Little by little over the years, this became rarer and rarer. And even dreaming became rarer. But there's a sense of dipping into a place of enormous restfulness and wisdom that's present in sleep, and that I that is just a part of my sleep life, and I don't feel like I did anything to have it happen. It just evolved.
There was a statement in a book I picked up, and it was just a transcript of a talk by a teacher who said that at an advanced level of enlightenment or awakening, dreams stop happening, that you no longer dream. And because it was a transcript, you know, you couldn't probe the question or probe the statement. And he didn't elaborate on what that meant, whether it was a matter of taking control of the dream or somehow you had a blank slate all night. You were so deep in the what you spoke of as the deepest layer, you know, dreams were not a phenomenon anymore somehow. But I wondered if that were true. I can have an amazing meditation And if it's late at night and I'm going to sleep shortly after, sometimes the contrast is so sort of disturbing, because I can have an amazing bliss. I can have something that penetrates through to where I feel like I'm at one with the tiniest electron spinning in every atom in the universe. And then I go to sleep and I have these very mundane, they're not very disturbing dreams. They're not dreadful images. They're very mundane, shopping for food and seeing, one of a cast of characters that keep showing up in dreams, many of whom are now dead because I'm 65 years old. But that contrast, I've often thought in recent years, should be leveling out some. And I do have amazing dreams. I have amazing dreams sometimes. I do have the dreams with that seem to be a vision of an amazing energy universe, but they're, the population is crowded out by, that more chaotic, mundane, something I watched in a movie showing up, that kind of thing. So now I've overspoken. I'm sorry.
No, you haven't. But what you're describing, I think, is something that all of us here have experienced.
Okay,
so here's the thing. We have our realization, we have our, let's call it our higher self, our higher mind, and we have our karma. And our daily life is an expression of our karmic conditioning. So when the Yoga Vashishta and also the New Thought teachings tell us that you can control your outer life through your thoughts, this is true only if, to a large extent, you've let go of that karma that is making your mind work in the way it does. And, this is why meditation, sometimes years of meditation, is necessary for most people, because every time you dip into a deep state of meditation, it's going to dissolve some of those karmic threads. But it's very natural that you would be in a meditative state with all of its feelings of beingness and bliss. You go to sleep and then you're back in your karma, which is, much of our karma plays out in dreams. So you could almost say that the meditation has kind of triggered the karmic display of endless, stupid, mundane activities that goes on in the dream. It's not a mistake. It's just how karma runs itself out. Karma has to be played out in general in order to be resolved. So I think it's actually a sign that your meditation is dredging up stuff from the inner mind and allowing it to play itself out. Then it goes and it's done. And there's ultimately more and more clarity in the mind as those habit patterns, those samskaric patterns, are played out and dissolved.
Thank you, Sally.
Thank you, Andrew. It's a very good question. So,
do you want to go on to Carolyn B. asked a question about following her breath?
So Carolyn says, when I follow my breath in meditation, I often experience like a bolt of electric shock going through my lower forehead, forcing my eye muscles to contract and pulsate. This is painful, but it creates a very tranquil mind for several hours and leaves a residue of low-grade pain. This type of event also can happen when I do mantra meditation. Is there any adjustment to meditating that you would advise, or should I continue what I've been doing as I practice your teachings from this telecourse? So this experience in the eyes is called Bindu Bedu. It's it's actually a yogic kriya that is the result of your inner shakti moving up into these chakras. And these kriyas are often accompanied by some pain, some discomfort. But what they're doing, if you think of let's say, think of all the blockages you have in your sinuses, or the blockages that you might have in the muscles around the eyes. These kriyas are dissolving those blockages, and you experience, you kind of re-experience them as they're dissolving. So it's a good thing, and it will not last forever. It is actually purifying these centers in your body, and as the centers become more purified, the Shakti will start working someplace else. So no, I don't see any reason why you should adjust it. Just as much as possible, be in the witness, be the witness, be the awareness that knows this is happening, rather than identifying with the pain itself. And that more than anything else really makes a difference. So with mantra practice, one of the things that mantra does is it literally dredges up stuff from your unconscious. It's a practice, mantra, I would say more than almost any practice we do, maybe with the exception of breathing, but it brings up the stuff that's hidden in your subtle body and expels it, dispels it. But as it's being expelled, we're going to feel it. We're going to feel the emotions related to it. We might even, you know, feel like something's going wrong because it's not our usual experience, but it's really is all part of the process. So again, thank you for that. Thank you for that that question. And yes, you should continue as you are. Do the practices and be interested in what's happening. Be curious about what's happening. Sure. And if something seems untoward, you can always write me a letter, and I'll see what I can do to help you resolve it.
Yeah, we go to Annabelle, who's got her hand up.
Hi, Annabelle.
Hi, Sally. These have been such great questions and answers. I really just want to acknowledge everyone for that.
Yes.
I have so many questions, and I feel so inarticulate that I feel like even embarrassed to even talk about anything. there's something about this course that's really made me go into my head, I think, much more than usual. And so I'm trying to figure everything out, which of course doesn't work. But I found that the course that was so helpful for me was the Bhakti course. It just felt so natural to who I am, and I could just go right into the meditations, and it was just smooth sailing. And this one, it feels like it's upended the cart, you know, and this feeling of that there's all these puzzle pieces that I have all these experiences, I have all these bits of awakening, I have all these visions and things that come, and they're all like pieces of this puzzle, but I have no idea how to put the puzzle together, and I can't find the edge, you know, the puzzle to start putting it together. And maybe I'm not even supposed to, but there's something about these teachings that have, you know, made me go into my head and like question everything.
Yeah, yeah.
And I, is it okay just to go back to the Bhakti class?
Absolutely. It's fine. It's fine. Totally. And, you know, a lot of you here, and I include myself, are very comfortable with Bhakti practice, very comfortable with specifically Shakti-oriented practice where feeling and sensation becomes an object of meditation. That said, and those are true paths, and it's important to know where you're naturally drawn. But that said, these teachings, you know, of which the great Vedantic texts like the Yoga Vishista and others, and the great Shaivite texts like the Pratyabhijna Hridayam and the Shiva Sutras, they're constantly pointing you towards that which is the underpinning of all this. And they also recognize as that there are layers of our consciousness, and that our experience at different layers and levels is going to be quite different from our experience at another layer or level. And I totally get why you would try to figure it out. I've spent years figuring it out. It's one of the reasons, it's one of the things you do when you're teaching, you know, is you try to understand intellectually how all these parts of our human organism fit in with our divine organism. And you know, as you think about it, as you read the text and think about it, wisdom is going to arise. But no, you don't want to make yourself crazy by getting completely into your mind. And you're right that it distracts from the experience. It distracts from the heart. But it's very, very useful to hold these ideas, to give yourself time to hold these ideas, and to put up with the discomfort of the fact that as we approach vichara, which is really what you're doing when you start asking these questions, you're doing vichara. And that, you know, when you ask the question, who am I, or what am I, or where does this thought arise, or, you know, what is the truth? Many, many layers and answers are going to come up. And, you know, and that can feel quite distracting and like you've lost the thread. But what that process is actually a purification of your intellectual conditioning. And it's quite useful to let it happen and to keep coming back to the heart. You know, you let it go on. And then at a certain point you go, okay, enough of this. I'm going to go back to my mantra and the heart and, you know, allow the witness to be present and just ask myself, where is awareness? Can I feel it? But don't get yourself lost in looking for awareness, asking yourself, is this awareness? You know, is this the witness, etc.? Because your mind will come up with all sorts of answers. It's best to take a kind of know nothing approach to vichara. In other words, you ask the question and you pay attention to what arises that's not verbal. Because if you ask yourself, where is awareness? Awareness is going to answer. But to hear it, to feel it, to sense it, we actually have to be willing to let go of the verbal answers, the doubts, the questions, just for a moment, and feel what is arising that's wordless. And in time, as you do this, the heart experience, you know, the love part that seems to be mostly located in the heart, and the awareness witness part, they do begin to integrate. They integrate as you go back and forth between awareness of awareness and just letting go into the heart of the mantra or your sense of connection with the deity. This is balancing your practice. And yes, you can let go of all this and it's fine. But what about,
I have these visions or experiences and then I kind of don't know what to make of them. But again, that's going into my head. I'm trying to, like, may I give you an example? I don't want to take too much time. So recently I had this really intense experience where I was shown the point of coming into incarnation. So in other words, I was right at that point. So in front of me was going to be coming into that contraction, and like on the other side of me was this vast flowing light and like an ocean of, you know, of whatever we are. And there were these beings that were kind of like midwives there that were going to help. And I was shown, I mean, it's like, I don't know why I was shown this. And I was shown how the different quality between the all and the contraction of going into a body, and how tight and constricted, and it had this rumbling sound, and the other was this kind of different sound. And it's like, okay, this was like mind blowing. What, you know, why am I being shown this now? That's an example. So then I take this class and I start thinking, well, how does that fit into, if it's all awareness, is that just my mind making this all up? And if so, then what? I mean, anyway.
Well, if you read the story of Leela, and there are a number of other stories throughout the book, which of people who have experiences like the one you're talking about, who travel to different worlds, who see many things about the whole process of the divine taking form as a as a manifest being. All of these are part of the, the way I like to think of it is that as that vastness sort of, you know, rumbles around in itself, and the Shakti aspect of it begins to exercise her radical creativity, which is part of the nature of consciousness, she manifests all this crazy stuff, all this fascinating stuff. And she does it so that she can enjoy it. And when you're having an experience like that, it's like the knowledge of what has actually happened and what is continuing to happen in your life as you move from, you know, your experience, your total non-separate experience of the wholeness into your extremely separate experience of being a person in a body. This is wisdom that is being offered to you. From another point of view, we could say this is wisdom that Shakti is offering to herself. She's teaching herself as you. And there's not, ultimately, there's not a difference between the Shakti that's making that experience arise within itself and the experience that you as Annabelle are having in your body as you begin to recognize the deeper layers of your human and divine experience. So it's not, why is she showing this to me? It's that at this point in your life, your consciousness is, the screen of your consciousness is clear enough so that she can show these things. She can display these things on your consciousness. Who is it that's experiencing them, that's watching them? It's her. So you see what I mean? So at one level, you are her. You're seeing as her through this personal incarnation. At another level, you're this person who's going, oh my God, how come I get to see this? You know, but they're both simultaneously happening. And that's the beauty of this play. I mean, that's why when the great beings see what's happening, they say things like, oh mother, how have you become all this? Or, you know, I've fallen into the ocean of consciousness and I can see everything arising and subsiding in it. It happens. You know, in other words, consciousness is not blank. Consciousness holds infinite potential, infinite images, infinite pieces of wisdom, infinite beings, and we get to experience some of them.
Yeah, I guess I've always sort of felt that it's like when I go into that pure awareness state, it's like the sound stage of God, and any movie can happen.
Exactly, you know? Well said.
Yeah. No. All right, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for the question. So let's see.
Do you want to take Lakshmi?
Sure.
She had her hand up.
Okay.
Hi, Sally.
Hi, Lakshmi.
I just wanted to say thank you. It's so lovely to be back in Sangha with you and with everybody who's here and in the course and not on the call. And it just, I'm just so overjoyed to be here. So,
yeah,
and my question is kind of about the geography or topography of awareness, if you will. And the first during the first session when you were guiding us through the ajna back, you know, above the palate and into the ajna, the way that I entered and the way that awareness felt from that experience was extremely different than the awareness that arises when I enter through the back of the heart, or when I've worked with some Dzogchen people, when the instruction is to go into the field, or when the awareness comes even just through riding the vertical channel. And, you know, to some extent, I get that maybe that's working different layers of consciousness or layers of awareness or metabolizing different aspects of being. And And then when you had us do this week, I am just following that am and staying at the bottom. And that felt like a depth charge. I just went, it just, you know, they felt, I felt in a different place and space in relation to the energy. And I guess I wanted, maybe if there's some things you could say just about that experientially, but also why we would enter in certain places or certain ways, or using I am versus Hamsa versus who am I, you know, the other than there are different tools for different people in different times, but why would we choose to do one or the other, if that makes sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. So first of all, what you said, there are different tools for different people at different times. My experience of every one of these practices is that depending on the time, depending on your state, any one of them can be the trigger for entering into pure awareness. So, and they have, as you say, they have a very different flavor. It's a very different flavor if you're practicing through the upper chakras than if you're practicing in the heart. And there's a whole other flavor. I don't know if you've ever done this with me. I think you have. You know, where we go into the lower muladhara beneath the body, and we meditate there. You bring your awareness down below, you know, about 10 inches below the body, and you just hold it there. And there's an opening that occurs, and that has a particular feeling. I would describe it. It's thicker. It's got more of a ground feeling. It's much less. It doesn't trigger thinking. Whereas the energy behind the heart, to me anyway, and maybe this is true for you, there is this feeling of just relaxing into the open embrace of a very loving energy that's, you know, kind of holding you from behind. And the experience of going into awareness through that portal is, has a lot of kind of emotional comfort in it. Whereas the meditation of going into consciousness through this portal is, you know, again, this is my experience, is quite electric. It has more movement in it, and it tends to be more light, where the back of the heart tends to be more feeling. So every, you know, your subtle body is an entire country with many different landscapes, and that's what's happening as you pass through these landscapes. They carry it, you know, you can have a visual experience. Generally, there's a kinetic experience. So essentially what we do when we try these different, you know, interventions, these different meditative techniques, is we're exploring our subtle being. We're exploring the different layers of our consciousness. We're bringing to consciousness areas of ourself which we may never have realized were there. That's why I do all these different practices. It's why I like to give them, because they help us, they literally help us bring to consciousness what has been hidden. You know, Jung always talks about, what does he say? He says, what you bring to consciousness will save you. What you keep in the dark will, I can't remember the words, will destroy you, I think is what he says. It's not Jung, it's the Gospel of Thomas. And when we read that, we think, oh, he's talking about, you know, our hidden childhood wounds or our negative, cruel feelings that we need to bring them out, look at our shadow. But I believe that, and that's all good, but essentially what we need to do is bring out the different, let's call them rooms, of our divine body, of our subtle body, and get to know them and realize that each one of them has something to show us, something to give us. We don't have to choose to get to know it, but in most people's lives, there comes a time when you're really drawn to experiencing the back of the heart. You're really drawn to experiencing the regions of light above the crown. And you also need to experience the ground. And that's what it that's what we're doing. We do all these different practices. We're integrating these different aspects of ourselves. So that's why you might choose to vary your practice.
Yeah, that makes sense. And it resonates with it. Just it felt this particular time, the way we went in, I had this inclination. It felt like there were just like granthis, like small granthis just being released. I just felt released in all these different ways. And then at some point my consciousness went, there was like, it said, go down there. And I went like broke through. And, but it was an internal, it came from this and that internal guidance. And so that makes sense to get in touch with the different doorways into our own guidance, I guess. So
yeah, exactly. And you know, when you are really in meditation, you're going to be shown through that inner guidance. It, you know, it might come as a voice, might come as a prescription. Generally speaking, it just comes as a kind of unspoken directionality that you're drawn to. So I think that's great.
Thank you.
Yes. So L.T. Wilson says, in a community, if a prominent theme emerges, such as our focus on Vedanta and Tantra and Kashmir Shaivism, what influences collective learning and knowledge transfer? When seeking understanding or guidance, should there be a step for self-identifying at a samadhi level or a jhana level? For example, inquiries and responses could be contextualized, tagged by mentioning a level such as Sahananda Samadhi or Sa-Asmita Samadhi or Jnana Tanamasi or Jnana Satvapati to continue to fuse perspectives. Wow, this is a bunch of questions. Could we boost clarity by adding references to bodies, to the causal, the subtle, to the gross, to the you know, to koshas? Yeah, it's very helpful for some people to identify the different layers, the different layers of the bodies, the different koshas. And for a period of time, it can be quite clarifying. So I'm all for it. It's one of the reasons why we study yogic lore, is so that we can start to identify this for ourselves. There's a danger here. You know, once again, it's like everything else, it requires balance. When we start that process, especially if we're very intellectually centered, and I sympathize with that question because I'm quite intellectually centered myself. And I spend a lot of time in meditation going, okay, is this the buddhi that I'm experiencing or is this the witness? Is this what ahamkara feels like? Is this how the ego displays? How do I know I'm in the subtle body? You know, how can I come out of deep sleep holding the wisdom of the causal body? In other words, as you study these, you know, these categories and start to check them against your experience, it can be very clarifying and very interesting. And in the end, it's a distraction. You know, I've often sat in meditation and my consciousness will start to expand in a particular way. And a line from one of the Shiva Sutras or the Prajapigna Hridayam will come and comment on that experience. And if I allow it to be, oh, okay, this is that, and let it go, it's great. If I let myself start thinking about it, it's a distraction like any other. So yeah, it's helpful. This information is helpful. And I don't teach it so much these days, partly because I kind of assume that all of you already know it, which I know isn't entirely true, but also because we do get so completely fascinated with the details, and they can be helpful and they can also be something that we take refuge in and believe that we're making progress because we understand better. But understanding is only a piece of it. So so yes, if it helps you to boost your clarity, to use these categories as ways of understanding your experience, 100%, I'm all for it. And another course you mentioned, my guru said, sometimes I fall out, but I always know how to get back. It's getting back related to traversing bodies. I think in one sense it is, but so most of us, most people are living in our subtle bodies. Karen wrote, sent a little paragraph in from a written course by a man named Ram Butler, whom some of you know, who basically did a course on non-duality for many, many years. It's quite good. You get a lesson every 2 weeks, and you would read it, and then awareness would, you know, wisdom would arise. So one of the things in that little message that Karen sent is he's saying your entire experience of life is an experience in the subtle body, which is another way of saying what Vashista is saying, that is, the world appears in the mind. For many of us, especially moderns, to actually go into the physical body and, you know, feel the muscles in your thighs and feel the movements in your belly actually takes some effort, because our attention is mostly, you know, in the subtle body, and our life is mostly being lived through the subtle body. So, and the subtle body has many, 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 many layers. So, you know, there's let's call it the ordinary layer where you're thinking or seeing images. And then there's the deeper and deeper layers where you're actually experiencing the energy of the chitta, the energy of the mind, and getting back into the state that Muktananda was talking about is actually about letting yourself either sink through the layers of energy of shakti that you're experiencing in the subtle body till you get to the place where, if you're thinking, your primary awareness is of the energy of the thought, not of the content. That's one way to do it. It's what I would call the shakta way of doing it. The other way of doing it is to just be the witness, be the knower, be awareness. That's going to catapult you out of an ordinary state of consciousness. Just saying, what knows that I'm having this horrific experience? What knows that I'm in a shouting match with my first cousin? And turning your attention to that knowingness is going to shift your perspective in a moment. The characteristic of a radically practiced or enlightened being is that they can do it like that. The characteristic of a person on the path is that it takes a bit more effort. But once you know the pathways, either the pathway through the energetics of your consciousness or the pathway that lets you bypass, as it were, I know that's a pejorative term these days, but it lets you transcend the movements of the mind and be aware of yourself as the knower of it, the awareness of it, the awareness that holds it all. They're both methods. One is, we could call it the Shakta method, the energy method. The other we could call the Shiva method, the pure awareness method. They both work. Many of us here combine them. And one of the reasons that I wanted to teach the Yoga Vashista, aside from the fact that I just adore it, is that it's actually schooling us in using our capacity for connecting to pure consciousness in such a way that we really are balancing, let's call them the awareness and energetic, or the awareness and love aspects of our consciousness, that we can receive the gifts that each one of them has to give us, even though we may be more energetically oriented. Nonetheless, even so, we really do need to be able to be aware of awareness, because that's what's going to eventually allow us, when we die or when we want to go into very deep meditation states, it's what's actually going to allow us to transcend our ordinary experience. And then, of course, we have to kind of come back and include it. But if we don't learn how to transcend it through identifying with awareness, we're always going to somehow believe that all we are is this, you know, all we are is our karma. So I hope that helps.
That's very helpful. Thank you, Sally.
Good. What's your first name?
Larry.
Larry, hi.
Hi.
I didn't want to call you LT, although maybe that's what people call you.
Either way, thanks.
Do we want to take Anne? She had her hand raised.
Sure.
Go ahead, Anne. Oh. It's showing that you have audio, but. Oh. We can't hear you.
Okay.
Okay. Maybe you can go on to Deb, Johnny. There we go.
Hi, thanks, Sally. I have a question that focuses to another practice that I do, which I'm trying to reconcile with the work that you typically do and also with this course. So back in December, I went on a retreat where we did a concentration practice, Vipassana and Metta. And particularly, I think, on the Vipassana practice, there was a strong steer. They didn't say don't do it, but it was sort of framed as though mantra was not helpful because it was sort of taking you away from being present to your own energies and the sensations of your body. And more so, deity practice was even more unhelpful because that was, I guess, in the realm of imagination. And, you know, like I think I found both of them useful in different ways, like given me very different experiences. But I'd love to hear from you on whether you see these as different schools of thought. Can they be reconciled, or are they just like, you know, like just two opposing worldviews, really?
Well, I have a bit of an issue with that, you know, that Vipassana viewpoint. And it's a long quarrel between Hindus and Buddhists, so which we want to stay out of, because the truth is there are times when Vipassana practice, we're really tuning into the sensations, to the sensations in the body, the sensations of thought. And we do that a lot. It's one of my favorite practices. It's that approach to practice is extremely useful and helpful in the ways that it is. One of the things it does not do is open you to the incredible reservoir of divine love and bliss that is inside your subtle body. I mean, I know that people who practice Vipassana do experience divine love and bliss, and that metta practice is, you know, loving kindness practice is a very skillful way of experiencing love. But having a enlivened mantra and allowing it to open your heart is going to take you to a level of bliss, a level of your own love that very few other practices will give you with such immediacy. So my position is that we need to get to know ourselves, and let's call it our strengths and weaknesses, and learn how to calibrate our practice to what is needed at a given moment. So if you're really feeling ungrounded and spacey and, you know, and life is very fraught, one of the ways that we ground ourselves and that we also get ourselves to detach from our emotional states is by some form of Vipassana. Okay, how does my body feel? What's going through my mind? Can I be aware of thoughts without getting caught in them? It's a tremendously powerful practice. On the other hand, if we are if we really want to quickly and immediately take ourselves from a state of intense thinking into a state of open-hearted, pure awareness, mantra is one of the fastest and most powerful ways to do that. And I gave you a sequence which you can do, in which you actually combine a Vipassana practice, a Vipassana style practice, with a more devotional practice, or with a mantra, or with the direct self-inquiry. You can integrate all of them into your practice. And what happens as you do that is that you develop different subtle faculties. And, you know, basically they're all helpful. And my lifelong issue as a practitioner and as a teacher, and I've been doing this for about 50 years. When I first started teaching, the Buddhists I knew and the Buddhists who were beginning to come to prominence in the American spiritual world took a very hardline attitude towards mantra practice, similar to what it sounds like is going on in this workshop. You know, mantra is just illusion. It's just pasting good feelings over unexamined states, and it's not going to liberate you. Whereas the devotional path would say it's only through mantra that you can dissolve the obstructions inside your body mind. You know, mantra has a power to just cut through all this stuff, and it also helps awaken Kundalini. And in most of these bhakti and yogic and tantric traditions, there's a tremendous importance placed on allowing Kundalini to do her work, which is really the difference between, you know, your life being just one long slog of meditative self-effort and having some help from the higher realms. So I've just come to realize that to be hard ass about it, that people who think that their path is the right path are ignorant, because all of the great paths are going to take you there, some sooner, some later, some more fitted to your temperament, some more fitted to someone else's temperament, but they all come from the wisdom of great beings, and they are all infused with enlightenment, with liberating Shakti. So yes, do a Vipassana practice. It's great to learn it. It's great to do it. And don't forget the power of mantra. So yes, they are different paths. And yes, they can be integrated. And for me, the really important thing about spirituality in this particular time and space, you know, where there's so much available and so much of it seems to be in contradiction, and the world is in so much trouble and needs so much help from conscious people who are able to connect to consciousness and help it spread inside this field of the world, we really need to integrate it all. We need to recognize the power of all of these practices and know how to add them to our own repertoire of techniques, such that they're available to us when there's a need for a particular approach. And I just want to say that's my deepest belief about spiritual practice. It's not one size fits all, and it's not one size fits you all the time. And there's something profound to learn from every one of these traditions.
Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for the question. So I think we've gone a little bit over the time we've allotted. It's just ecstatic to have this conversation with you. And I thank you so much for these brilliant and deep questions. So let's just take 2 minutes to let all this go. Follow the breath. And And with the breath, let's offer our blessings to everyone here, everyone who's live on the call and everyone who's listening tomorrow or next week. May all these beings be happy. May all of us be at peace. May all of us be safe. May all of us be healthy. And as you follow the breath, see if you can use the English words, the English mantra, I am, to reveal to your inner consciousness the inner nonverbal experience of being, which the I am mantra actually refers to. So say to yourself, I am, and then let yourself rest in the space, the felt sense that arises in your consciousness at the end of I am. That being, that nonverbal I am, which exists on every single level of consciousness. At the beginning, it's more of a felt sense. As you take it deeper and deeper, it becomes, we could just say, lighter and more evanescent. But the feeling, the felt sense of being is never different from itself, and it is that which is present at every level of experience. So if your question wasn't answered, please feel free to send it in on the listserv, and I will answer them. And other people are invited to answer them also on the listserv. So thank you so much. I'm sorry that the homework didn't get to you until this morning because my computer stopped working yesterday and I didn't realize it had happened. So I actually didn't get to send it out to Deb until last night. But it's all there.
I am I just uploaded it to the site and I'll be sending it out here shortly.
Oh, fantastic. Thank you, Deb. And I apologize for not realizing that my computer had lost its marbles for a few hours. So thank you all so much. And thank you, Deb, so much. And we'll see you on Thursday and in the ether in between. Namaste. Thank you.